Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
I must begin with a mea culpa. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. It is a minor mea culpa, though, or I'm sorry, that in the previous episode, I didn't get to the debrief of my dialogue with John Loftus. I thought I would. You know, when I do these shows, I put an outline for myself. I got an outline in front of me, and I've done over 200 of these episodes, which, by the way, is only possible by our subscribers at TrenthornPodcast.com. Consider becoming a subscriber so we can do 200 more episodes and reach thousands and thousands of more people. But normally, I've got it figured out how much I want to cover. But sometimes, I'm a glutton for information and truth. I want to cover so much with you, but I also want to be respectful of your time. That's why I've tried very hard with this podcast to keep it pretty uniform. Around, I'd say on average, the episodes are about 35 minutes. I find that's a helpful amount of time. People can usually cover one episode a day in their commutes or, you know, whatever they're doing, and we're doing three episodes a week. So I want to be respectful of your time. And if I have a lot of content, sometimes I'll stretch us into the 40-minute mark or so. Even with the dialogues, when they go on to 60 or 90 minutes, I divide those up into half-hour episodes for your convenience. But if I have just so much, sometimes I will make the executive decision to move that content towards another episode. So in this week's episode, I'm going to start with my dialogue and debrief on John Loftus. I'm not going to put it to the end because I'm going to be tempted to talk a lot about the latter part of this episode, and that's dealing with the Amazonian Synod and that ceremony that took place in the Vatican Gardens a few days ago that a lot of people on social media were talking about. And a lot of people asked me, Trent, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And I was hesitant to want to talk about this because I don't want to have mission creep. In doing this podcast and everything that I do, I always try to abide by the principle that he who does everything does nothing. That if you stretch yourself too thin, then you're not going to be able to effectively accomplish what God wants you to do in the world. So there are people who have decided for their media platforms and what they want to blog about or podcast about, whatever it may be, they focus on what is happening within the church, on, you know, kind of the news in the church or what clerics are doing, what the Pope is doing, and analyzing whether it's prudent or a good idea for them to do these things. Some people use very sometimes heavy-handed language in denouncing what some of these clerics are doing. But in other cases, sometimes the clerics are royally messing up so badly from a liturgical, canonical, or even a criminal standpoint, the hard language is justified. But in other cases, I see in some of this online commentary on the church today, there can be a bit of hyperbole and exaggeration. So here's the thing. I have not felt called to be in that area. That's why I chose to work for Catholic Answers and not for another kind of apostolate. Catholic Answers has a very specific mission. We explain and defend the Catholic faith. And on this podcast, what I want to focus on are essentially two questions. What does the church teach? Does the church teach X? And is X true? So I want to clarify for Catholics, hey, here is what the church teaches on this particular subject. Either it has a definite teaching or it may not have a definite teaching on a certain subject. And then two, especially for critics who are non-Catholics or former Catholics, I want to say to them, hey, this teaching that you disagree with that the church proposes for belief, whether it's something that requires the religious submission of mind and will, it's a church teaching, or it's an infallible teaching, one that's infallible, one that cannot be changed, especially those that are dogmas. The church has definitively pronounced that these are infallible, they cannot change, and that they are part of divine revelation. And that's what I do most of my apologetic work is defending the dogmas of the church. So I'm defending the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and Mary's bodily assumption from Protestant critics. I'm defending the moral teaching that's infallible but non-dogmatic, such as the wrongness of euthanasia, for example, or the wrongness of abortion would be an infallible teaching of the church, one that cannot change. I will defend to show others it's supported by what we know from reason and what we know from revelation, or the dogma that God exists and we can know by reason that God exists when I'm dealing with atheists or even some Protestants who think that there are no good arguments for the existence of God and you can only know God exists through faith alone. That's a heresy called fideism. That's what people like Karl Barth were arguing for in, you know, the early part of the 20th century. And there's even Protestants today who argue for fideism. We'll have to cover that on another podcast. But when people share with me news items, especially they'll say, What's the Pope doing now? What's this bishop doing now? Why isn't this bishop doing this? Why is this guy doing that? And I'll express my opinion sometimes on social media on these things, but I don't want to get distracted by them because I don't feel like that is my particular mission. But so many people ask me to talk about this. I felt it might be a good lesson to talk about these things I was hearing about idolatry happening in the Vatican and what I think about the Amazonian Synod. And when the Synod's documents are released and completed, then I may comment on them because that deals with, hey, what does the church teach? And I think that'll be a good place for me to have an episode on that. So I will address that here at the latter part of the episode, but don't consider this to be a common thing that I want to do here on the podcast. I want to focus on what the church teaches. And is that teaching true? I mean, every now and then, yeah, controversies will arise and I'll address them. This isn't a hard and fast rule. I'm not making an infallible declaration that I'll never talk about these things. But I want you to know as a listener that what you'll receive from this podcast is uniform and that I'm approaching something particular. And also, I see, for me, the reason I want to focus on this area a lot is that I see a lot of people in the Catholic world, the blogosphere, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, that are, you know, bringing up matters of prudence, whether it's a good idea this bishop or the Pope or this priest is doing this or that, that not a lot of them are addressing, hey, here's this Protestant author or this atheist YouTuber who is attacking the church. Here's this person trying to make an argument for abortion. Who's going to go against them? I don't see a lot of Catholics out there debating atheists, debating abortionists, debating Protestant apologists, Reformed apologists. I feel called to do that. I'd love to see more people doing that because our faith is constantly under attack. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a place for people to comment on what's going on in the church. Some people feel called to do that, and that's fine. I'm just saying I don't feel called to do that as a primary or even a secondary part of my work here at Catholic Answers or through this podcast. But every now and then it'll come up, so we'll get to that shortly. First, without further ado, here's what I thought about the dialogue with John Loftus. So if you caught that a few episodes ago, I had a two-part dialogue with John Loftus. He is an atheist. He used to be, as he said in the episode, used to be Catholic, and then he fell away from the Catholic faith to become Protestant, an on-fire Protestant. But then later, he started having a lot of doubts about the faith. And if you read in his major work, Why I Became an Atheist, he goes into more detail about his personal life, and he's frank about it, that he engaged in certain sins that he regrets, and that was kind of concurrent with his fall from grace, so to speak. Now, I'm not going to say that John was just an atheist because of certain immoral decisions that he made in his life, but I'm also not saying those had nothing to do with it. I find that very common in both professional and personal deconversion stories. I remember once I was at the University of Kansas talking with a young woman who was this adamant atheist, and I asked her why she was an atheist, and she couldn't really give me good reasons, just kind of warmed over, you know, village atheist stuff that I hear online. And eventually I got to the reason why she stopped going to church is because her friends were mean to her and extremely critical of her for choosing to live with her boyfriend. Now, that obviously wasn't a good decision on her end, but her friends weren't exactly pastoral about it and helpful. You know, there's always that fine line between being firm and assertive and putting forward the teaching of the church and also being warm and inviting to call people to repent and to leave behind destructive lifestyles and to re-embrace the faith that provides them with true happiness. So John and I wanted to talk about his anthology, The Case Against Miracles. And I'm not going to go through the entire dialogue. I'm not going to go through point by point to talk about it, but I wanted to talk about just general principles in case you missed them and what you can learn more from this. So we were essentially focusing on the Scottish philosopher David Hume. He's an Enlightenment philosopher. I think he lived in the latter part of the 18th century. And Hume was not making the argument that miracles are impossible. He's not saying that the laws of nature are fixed and that there aren't miracles. Though there is an argument in that anthology. I alluded to it in the dialogue. So John's book is an anthology. John has a few entries in it, and there's other atheists who put entries. One of the atheists in there says, look, God would never do miracles. I thought that was the funniest argument. God would never do miracles. I alluded to this in the dialogue with Loftus. And why wouldn't he do miracles? Because people would say, well, it's not fair. If God miraculously heals this cancer patient, why didn't he heal this other cancer patient? If God miraculously performs a miracle to help feed 5,000 people in Judea, why doesn't he perform a miracle to feed people who are suffering from a famine in Africa? So because God would not be selective with miracles, therefore it follows that God does not exist. No, that's now we're moving from history to a philosophical argument. That's basically the problem of evil. And the counterexample I gave from that, that argument, God would not perform miracles because why didn't he help these other people? That doesn't show the miracle never happened. You have to evaluate the miracle on the evidence that's presented. And so, for example, I brought up with John, with Loftus, this example, this counterexample. That would be like saying, imagine if Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, you know, they've got billions of dollars at their disposal, and they decide to look up on the Department of Education's website, I'm sure you can't do this in real life, but bear with me, look up people who are struggling to pay their student loan debt. And they decide, I'm going to pick these 10 random people, and I'm going to pay off their student loans. It wouldn't be justified for those people to say, Bill Gates does not exist, because if this super rich person did exist, he wouldn't have just paid off my loans. He would have paid off all of these other people who had similar loans to me or had a similar circumstance to me. It wouldn't follow from that at all, that just because someone who has abundant abilities to help others, that doesn't mean they always have to help people beyond a certain means. Plus, when we look at God, if God is omnipotent, God can help people and provide them with the fullness of life. He just isn't obligated to do it here in this life, because ultimately God has given us the means to have eternal life with him and provide us with that perfect kind of happiness. It's not justified on our end to say, well, God has to give me perfect happiness right now in this life, or I'm not gonna believe in him. So Hume's argument when I was debating with Loftus was whether any testimony would be sufficient to establish a miracle. So you'll notice in the dialogue, though, that John often tried to take me on kind of a rabbit trail. And this is a good lesson for you all when you have conversations with people about the faith. Try to stay focused on one subject and don't get dragged away. So if you're talking about the existence of God, someone says, well, how could God exist when these, look at all the priests in this scandal, what they've been doing. Don't get dragged away by the priest scandal. Go back to God and say, well, why would God allow evil? Does evil show that there is no God? Could evil be evidence of God who is perfect goodness itself? Much the same way you'll notice John wanted to talk about, well, is there evidence for the virgin birth? Is there evidence for Christ's resurrection? Now, if I had gone down into that rabbit hole, well, what happens, we would have debated it back and forth, and I already used up a lot of time in the dialogue to talk about miracles themselves. I wouldn't be able to put forward an adequate defense of miracles that have occurred historically, like Christ's virgin birth or his resurrection from the dead. So instead, I told John, no, let's stay focused on this one question. Is it rational to believe in miracles? And I also brought up this point that I didn't want to debate whether certain miracles had ever happened, because it would be a fool's errand for me to do so if the atheist can just fold his arms and say, well, I don't care how much evidence you produce, because following David Hume, no evidence, no testimony is sufficient to demonstrate that a miracle has occurred. It just isn't, because any testimony that would prove the miraculous happened, the falsehood of that testimony would have to be more miraculous than the miracle it intends to affirm. And that's why when I asked John about his claim, his argument that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, I said, well, that's the ECRI principle. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that comes from Carl Sagan. I asked him, well, does this also include a MECRI principle, miraculous evidential claims, or MCRE principle? So if extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, then does that mean miraculous events require miraculous evidence? Well, if that's the case, if we need miraculous evidence for miraculous claims, then we need more miraculous evidence for that evidence. And the chain goes on and on. And the atheist has set the bar so high, you can never prove that a miracle happened in the first place. So that's why I felt like the dialogue was a huge success, because we started the dialogue with John. I asked him, is it possible for testimony to prove a miracle has happened? And he said no. But as we went through the conversation, he eventually admitted at the end that some testimony could establish a miracle, that it was possible. That is a huge 180 change. So now we've moved from philosophy. If it is possible, then we need to see, does the evidence for the resurrection, for example, satisfy that bar. That's why I asked John, look, what evidence would show that a miracle happened? And this will happen a lot with atheists. You know, say to them, what would prove God exists, or what would prove a miracle occurred? And they'll make these really grand claims, like, oh, well, if God came down from the sky, or if he wrote an inscription on the moon, or if we had we had thousands of witnesses who recorded the resurrection, and Jesus appeared to everyone on earth right now. No, I'm not asking what would be your favorite piece of evidence to have. I'm asking what is the bare minimum amount of evidence you will accept. And this is a strategy that you should employ when you're talking with atheists, to say, look, what is the bare minimum amount of evidence you will accept for the existence of God, or for that he's interacting in the world with miracles? Because in order to show you have an open mind, that you haven't just set the bar arbitrarily high, you have to say, look, what evidence would convince you? You can apply the same thing to abortion also. What would convince you that abortion is wrong? What would convince you the unborn is a human being? If people can't answer that question, that shows that they've already come to a conclusion in their mind, and they're not open-minded at all about the subject. They're just rationalizing their belief. Now, an atheist could turn this on me to say, what would convince you you're wrong? And I would say, well, if you could produce a logical argument that shows that God is a contradiction, he couldn't possibly exist, for example, that could get me to change my mind. Though then again, the way that God has revealed himself to me, my personal experience with God, which actually isn't a lot compared to other people, I've shared before that I don't have a lot of deep personal experiences of God in prayer, you know, the quote-unquote warm, fuzzy feelings. Not that they're just merely that, but a lot of my knowledge of God doesn't come from personal experience, and I think that's a good thing, because then I can help people who don't have that still have a lively faith in God and a rich faith that's based on sound thinking and sound reasoning that provides us a good foundation for faith, that we can hope in God and that we're able to love one another because God works in and through us. So a few other points that I brought up in this conversation with Loftus you should remember is that I owe this observation to Timothy McGrew. The fact that an atheist will say that miracles are rare, that's not evidence against miracles, that they're rare. Because a miracle by definition has to be rare. Otherwise it wouldn't be a miracle. It wouldn't get our attention. Because, it's just something we would expect in everyday life. We wouldn't think that God had miraculously intervened in the world if this were something that happened every day and was considered to be a normal part of nature. Also, when critics, people like Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. When they say these things, you should point out that the counterexamples they give about why, this is why it sounds plausible to people. They'll say, well, look, if I told you I have a cat in my garage, you'll believe me. If I told you I had a nuclear weapon in my garage, you probably won't believe me until I give, I really need to give you some good evidence for that. If I said that I had a dragon in my garage, well, you definitely aren't going to believe that unless you can go and see him. And then if I said I had an invisible dragon that's immaterial, well, you're not going to believe that at all. So you see, as the claims get more and more extraordinary, we need more and more evidence to believe. No, all that shows is that claims require good evidence. I agree that claims that are out of the ordinary require evidence beyond the mundane or the average. But it doesn't mean that you have to raise the bar so high that miraculous claims require evidence that is equally miraculous. No, you just need good evidence. Because in some cases, a person could just be joking. If someone says, I got a nuclear bomb in my garage, you might say, well, okay, you're just telling a joke, you're being lighthearted or kind of weird. If someone's insistent about it, I might think that they're a bit mentally off. But if someone has a degree in nuclear physics, or if there's someone who shows me how they've been studying nuclear weapons for years and they downloaded the plans from the internet, I might find it quite plausible they have a nuclear weapon in their garage. I just need more evidence, but not a ton more. But when it comes to things like, you're not going to believe if someone says I have a dragon in my garage, you're not going to believe that. Well, no, but that's because the existence of the dragon in the garage is outweighed by other evidence that dragons don't exist. Because if there were dragons, if there were these creatures around, there would be more sightings of them. And because there are not sightings of these creatures, that counts against their existence. And an invisible, immaterial dragon is even worse, because dragons are essentially embodied creatures. So an immaterial dragon is like a married bachelor. I don't even know what you're talking about at this point. You're just talking about a logical contradiction. So when atheists bring up, why don't you believe in these things? You can say, I don't believe in them simply because there's a lack of evidence, but because there's evidence against them. It's the same reason why I don't believe in Santa. Not just the lack of evidence for Santa, it's the fact that we have evidence Santa does not exist. We've been to the North Pole. We track radar. Parents buy presents to put under the tree. And that's the same thing. But when it comes to, let's say, Jesus rising from the dead, you don't have as comparable evidence that he did not rise from the dead. Yes, you have evidence that dead men stay dead, sure, but the Christian doesn't say that Jesus rose naturally from the dead. Rather, God miraculously intervened and Jesus rose from the dead. You can hold that proposition consistently with the proposition that dead men stay dead. If you want more on this, go back to that episode to listen. In the show description, I mentioned the work of Timothy McGrew, and he's got some good podcasts on this I think you may find very helpful. All right, let's move on to the next item, which you're probably all waiting with bated breath, about that ceremony, which some people have considered to be an act of idolatry happening in the Vatican Gardens. This is an article from Catholic News Agency. Ecological ritual performed in Vatican Gardens for Pope's tree planting ceremonies. Pope Francis witnessed an indigenous performance at a tree planting ceremony in the Vatican Gardens Friday, during which people held hands and bowed before carved images of pregnant women, one of which reportedly represented the Blessed Virgin Mary. A group of people, including Amazonians in ritual dress, as well as people in lay clothes and a Franciscan brother, knelt and bowed in a circle around images of two pregnant women who appeared to be semi-clothed in the presence of the Pope and members of the Curia. After witnessing the ritual, Pope Francis set aside his prepared remarks, opting instead to offer the Our Father without comment. So I noticed on one website, there was a criticism of this group of people bowing before this statue showing two pregnant women. And it included a quote from, it was a Catholic website, included the quote from Exodus from the Ten Commandments that says, "You shall not make any graven images." And I thought, well, dude, are you going to get mad about all of the statues of saints and the Blessed Virgin that we have in churches? You can't be mad at them just because they're bowing before a graven image. Now, what most people are concerned about, and I totally understand the concern, is that this was an example of bowing for an idol of an Incan fertility deity called Pachamama. The concern here is this group of people were bowing in reverence to not to anything that's Catholic in orientation, but to a pagan fertility goddess. So I'll address that shortly, but let's read through. Oh, before I get the rest of the article, notice Pope Francis set aside his remarks, opting instead to offer the Our Father without comment. And some people say, well, why didn't the Pope do anything? My response is, actually, it seems like the Pope definitely did do something. He did not offer a comment. Normally, the Pope has to go to these things all the time in the Vatican. And the article goes on to say, well, let me read it, what goes on to say, and then I'm going to comment on this. It says, Vatican spokesman Matteo Bruni told CNA Friday that at the end of the ceremony, the Pope decided to entrust his reflection, thoughts, and words to the prayer of the Our Father, which is in itself a message of faith. The ceremony in the Vatican Gardens, organized by the Global Catholic Climate Movement, Pan-Amazonian Ecclesial Network, and the Order of Franciscan Friars Minor, was described as a celebration of the Feast of St. Francis and the opening of the Synod of Bishops on the Pan-Amazonian region, October 6th to the 27th. So the Pope did not organize this. The Vatican did not even organize this, that they go and they have audiences with people who put on, you know, demonstrations for them, demonstrations of their culture, and usually present the Pope with various gifts. And a lot, he's not aware of these things. What I found interesting is that he did not offer any comment. Normally what he does is he'll give a short 2-minute remark saying, oh, thank you for your culture you've provided here. It's a beautiful expression, you know, talking about these separate things. Now, he didn't do that. Now, some people, I've looked at the video of the ceremony online. You start at the beginning, the Pope gets there. He seems tired, bored. I think he just seems really under the weather, kind of. When they start doing the circle dance, he's kind of sitting there looking down, reading his program. But then he takes note and people come up to him and then they offer him this statue, which one of the women present calls Our Lady of the Amazon. So she takes this statue, which, by the way, other people have said that in this ceremony there was a statue of a man with a phallus, like he is a fertility god. But when you look at the video closely, that's not a guy with a phallus. It's just a little figurine of a man with one of his arms outstretched. We don't know what it means. It could reference an Amazonian martyr, the faithful. I don't know, but it's definitely not a fertility god. And so one of the women goes and takes these this statue of what appears to be a pregnant woman whose breasts are bared, offers it to Pope Francis and says, calls it Our Lady of the Amazon. And when she does this, you can see that the Pope seems like he seems uncomfortable. He seems rigid. He's like, okay, thank you. And the Pope has to deal with awkward gifts all the time. I remember a few years ago, he was in Bolivia, and for Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, gave him a crucifix with Jesus on a communist symbol, the hammer and sickle. It was a communist crucifix, which is super offensive. And the Pope just looks at him. I think he mutters, not good. And he just tries to maintain a very solemn expression, and he accepts the gift. The fact that a Pope accepts a gift from someone does not mean that he condones what they're doing. He's just trying to be polite and cordial with them and maintain this kind of diplomatic relations with different kinds of people. But normally, even when Pope St. John Paul II was at events and he was tired and, you know, he was in his later years, he still would give a short address to thank people for being there. The fact that the Pope just said an Our Father, that's the bare minimum he would have to do, I believe communicates he was very uncomfortable with this ceremony and didn't want to offer anything else to it. Now, some people say, well, he should have just said down with these idols and gone and ripped everything up and thrown it in the trash. Well, you know, that's your decision of what you would want to do. The Pope may choose to do something differently to express by virtue of his office whether he's going to support something or not. Though I think that the Pope is more used to the delicacies of trying to share the faith and bring the faith to regions of the world that have sometimes mixed the faith with pagan or indigenous customs. And it's quite a balancing act to unthread those things. For example, when Jesuits went to the Far East, when they went to China and Japan to evangelize back in the 17th and 18th centuries, they took a very firm stance against ancestor worship, and they tried to stamp out anything that looked like ancestor worship, because of course that's idolatry, divination, and that's sinful. But they didn't offer anything in its place to try to channel it in a good direction, such as by offering people saying, well, you can't worship your ancestors like gods, but you can seek their veneration or their intercession, and to try to progressively lead people to the truth. They took a very heavy-handed approach to this, and that's, scholars have shown, is one of the reasons the faith did not take off as much in places like Japan and China. And even to this day, there is a deafening lack of a Catholic voice in these areas. So I think it's important that when we bring the faith to other cultures, we have to be cognizant of what is essentially and in and of itself contrary to the faith, and so it cannot be tolerated. And what are some things that are on the border and need to be rehabilitated? So, for example, this business of everyone bowing in front of this statue of a semi-nude pregnant woman. What's going on here? Let's just try to interpret that first just with as most charity as we can. This woman said that this is Our Lady of the Amazon. Now, it doesn't look like a Western portrayal of Our Lady of the Amazon, which is a real patronage, but we wouldn't expect that from indigenous people who are going to obviously present the Virgin Mary, Jesus, present holy men and women. They will do so in accordance with their own customs. I've been to the Church of the Basilica of the Annunciation in Nazareth many times, and I've seen wonderful paintings and sculptures of the Madonna and Child showing Jesus as a little Asian child with his little bunny slippers, and he's got only one bunny slipper on, and I'm like, that's my favorite one. It's the one from China. And you see Mary and Jesus being portrayed according to many different kinds of ethnicities. And when you see in the Amazonian region, it's quite common for women to have bare breasts. It's not something that we as a culture practice here in the Western world, but that's something that you can see in the Amazon and parts of Africa, and that's a cultural difference there. It's not something to be scandalized by. In fact, you look in Renaissance art, there is a wide variety of Renaissance art that shows Mary bearing her breast as she's feeding the newborn Jesus. So that in and of itself, that some people say, well, even if it is Our Lady of the Amazon, even if it is Mary, it's a scandalous thing. Well, it's a different culture. We may disagree with it. Now, some people have said, well, no, it can't be Mary because it's a pregnant woman. That's a fertility goddess. But there are depictions of Mary being pregnant. I have a painting in my own home from the website paintedfaith.net that shows Mary pregnant, looking down at her womb and adoring the Lord pregnant in her womb. So you can show the Virgin Mary being pregnant with Jesus. And to me, I want to err on the side. I think that this is just a represent what they said, Our Lady of the Amazon, it's a representation of Mary. I've looked up images of this Incan fertility deity, Pachamama, Mother Earth is basically what it means, Pachamama. And the images of Pachamama look a lot different than this particular rendering of a pregnant woman. Also, in those images, the pregnant woman, Pachamama, this fertility deity or Mother Earth, tends to have a swirl designed over her abdomen to represent she's mother of the planet Earth. Whereas this particular statue that was presented at the Amazonian Garden Festival, it actually has an inscription of a baby way over the womb. So that leads me, the evidence points more in the direction that this is not a, that it's not a statue of a pagan idol, that it's a indigenous representation of Our Lady. So that's what I think. If you disagree with me, that's fine. Once again, we're entering the area of prudential judgments here. That's why I'm not going to comment on this stuff all the time. If you want my opinion, I try to interpret it charitably. That's what it seems to be. And when you watch the rest of the ceremony, it's a very Christian ceremony in the Vatican Gardens. You know, say, what's all this stuff about nature and Earth and Mother Earth? Well, it's October 4th. It's the Feast of St. Francis. And when you read the Canticle of the Sun, which was penned by St. Francis, you can see how it would be appropriate to have all this, because St. Francis wrote in his Canticle of the Sun, you know, praise be you, my Lord, through brother wind, through sister water, through brother fire. Praise be you, my Lord, through sister mother earth, who sustains us and governs us and who produces varied fruits with colored flowers and herbs. But I don't doubt that there is a problem in the Amazon with folk Catholicism and a kind of blending of the worship of the Virgin Mary with some of these ancient deities. That's a common in many common problem in many indigenous areas. And so we have to come up with means to evangelize, to help people offer proper veneration of the Lord and maintaining indigenous and historical practices like certain kinds of chants or dancing, as long as it's not contrary to the faith, should be able to keep, but not blur the lines between pagan deities and God or the holy men and women of God. For example, in the book Power and Pilgrimage, it says that during colonization, so this has been going on for hundreds of years. During colonization, the Virgin Mary became associated with Pachamama. She is perceived not only as an intermediary between God and the people, Pachamama was seen as a goddess of fertility with independent powers. Most pilgrims still relate to the Virgin of Urcupiña, therefore independent powers attributed to her. So what we see here is kind of a blend of people in indigenous regions, take the Amazon, for example, where they will say, well, we used to worship, you know, Pachamama, the mother goddess, life, but now we see that Jesus is God, Mary is his mother, and Mary takes on or supplants this role that for the fertility goddesses and others once held. The book Moved by Mary makes a similar point. It says, because the Virgin Mary partly conflates with Pachamama for the Andean people, certain characteristics of Pachamama have been transferred to Mary. This occurs regardless of whether they perceive Pachamama and the Virgin Mary as one and the same or as two different entities. So if you're taking a group of indigenous people and trying to move them to the fullness of faith, you're going to move them gradually, which is the same thing that God did with the Israelites in the Old Testament, that he allowed them to believe, for example, that Yahweh was one of many gods, and that they were to worship him alone. And then later on in the time of Isaiah, the people of God came to the full understanding that Yahweh is mightier than any god, not just in power, wisdom, and goodness, but also in existence itself. I talked about this in a open mailbag a few weeks ago when people asked me about henotheism and monotheism in the Old Testament. This is what notice here, that it would be preferable for me to have an indigenous group of people that say, oh, the Virgin Mary just is this ancient fertility goddess, that goddess doesn't really exist, and we venerate Mary, who gives life to all Christians, who prays for us, who intercedes for us. That, okay, we're moving on the path towards saying we want to abandon these pagan, these deities that don't really exist, and move you towards worship of the true God and veneration of the true saints. It's moving on this kind of gradual pedagogy to get people to the truth. Now, one objection is to say, why not take a heavy-handed approach? You know, the church has done that before. Think about Saint Boniface, who cut down the sacred pagan oak. Why not take a heavy-handed approach that conquistadores and other missionaries have took towards pagan indigenous practices in the past? Now, this objection, I see the merit, but the problem is that these approaches churches might have worked well when the church had more, not just spiritual authority, but temporal authority in a region as well, to say this is how things are going to be going to go, both from the church perspective and the state perspective. But today, many indigenous cultures are under the protection of secular governments that themselves are very anti-Catholic, that will say, we don't want missionaries here. You're imposing your cultural values. We don't want you here. And so it can be a lot to even try to get there to evangelize in the first place. I think about the peoples on North Sentinel Island. I talked about that Christian missionary who was killed by the Sentinelese people, one of the last unevangelized peoples on Earth off the coast of India, that the Indian government prohibits missionaries, prohibits visitation to these peoples, partly for your own protection so you don't get killed, but also to keep them out of contact from Westerners. So if you come in with a very heavy-handed approach, there could be a backlash on the indigenous people saying, nope, we don't want you here anymore. You can take off and leave. We're going to have our local shaman and do things our way. And the local governments may say, your travel visas are revoked. You can't come in here anymore. And so do you want to take a heavy-handed approach that could fail and ultimately lose people and fail to convert them down the line and evangelize them? Or do you want to take an incremental approach that is not compromising, does not tolerate or sanction things like idolatry, but works with people where they are at to bring them ultimately closer to Christ and to the fullness of his truth? And so that's why, if you think about it, God tolerated evils in the Old Testament. He could have said, no, you can't divorce your spouse. Marriage is permanent. Tough cookies, kids. And then St. Thomas Aquinas says, well, the reason God didn't do that is because he didn't want people murdering their spouses. They weren't ready to receive the fullness of that teaching until they were under grace. So God progressively moved them towards the full acceptance of the truth. And that's just something we have to deal with other indigenous cultures who have folk Catholicism, who still have a lot of superstitious elements that we have to gradually, not that we just sit around and sing Kumbaya and never offend people, but always have to be prudent and tactful in leading people towards truth and away from error, idolatry, and superstition. And that's something that seems to have happened in the Old Testament. I wrote in my book, Hard Sayings, a few years ago about how this seemed to happen in the Old Testament with the acknowledgement that Yahweh could be identified by different names and different deities. I wrote, there is also evidence that the God of the Israelites, Yahweh, was worshipped in Canaan under the name El, who was the supreme god of the Canaanite pantheon of deities. According to Old Testament scholar Mark Smith, although the Bible fiercely criticizes other pagan deities like Baal, there, quote, there are no biblical polemics against El. At an early point, Israelite tradition identified El, which was the high god in the Canaanite pantheon, with Yahweh, or presupposed this equation. In fact, the name Israel, means El will rule. So what we see here is maybe happening in the Amazon when you see people, and now I don't think this is the case in the Vatican Gardens, that this was worship of the idol Pachamama or a fertility goddess. I am not convinced of the evidence for that. I think it's what this woman said. It's Our Lady of the Amazon. But who knows? It could be something else. And it's idolatry. It's, what a royal mess up. I would be thoroughly upset if that's were the case. And I think that the Pope didn't know what was happening, and maybe he had an inkling this is not entirely kosher, and that's why he didn't give an address and he wanted to just get out of there. Now, you can offer your insights, your opinion on whether it's prudent for the Pope to do that or not, but that's a matter of prudence left for us to judge. But it's probably the case that in parts of the world, like in the Amazon and other or in other indigenous cultures around the world, you have people who have mixed Catholicism with folk mythology, with superstitious practices, and there's a sign of moral and theological improvement in that maybe they identify God, Jesus, the Blessed Virgin as being the real expression of these things. That what we thought was the case, that, you know, just like the ancient Israelites said, oh, you Canaanites worship El, the high god of the Canaanite pantheon. Well, we worship him too. Yahweh is the head of everything. You know, Yahweh is El. It's not a problem. But that's not true, but it's something that was an accommodation of truth to lead the Israelites along the path to ultimately reach monotheism. And that's the same thing that we might progressively have to lead indigenous cultures who can be moved to say, hey, what you venerate in your previous tradition, you find the fullness of that expression here within the Catholic faith. And then finally, once they can receive that, you can see the fullness that what is contrary to the faith in your previous superstitious or indigenous expression is something you can no longer hold. It's like when St. Paul said in his letters, he had a pastoral principle, milk before meat, that trying to bring people into the faith, you give them teachings that are digestible first, and then once they understand the basic tenets of the faith, you can move them into deeper and deeper truth. So I hope that's helpful for you. And you know what? You might say, Trent was totally off on this. You know what? That's fine. Once again, these are matters of prudential judgment. I'm offering my thoughts on this. If you disagree with me, feel free to go to trenthornpodcast.com. You can list what you think there. And I'm open to that because what I care about most is the truth. And people might complain about the way I express it, but deep down, I just want to get the truth right for whatever parties are involved. Because the truth is ultimately what led me to the Catholic faith in the first place and is what kept me in the Catholic faith and will keep me here regardless of whatever dopey, bizarre, stupid, or sinful criminal things may be happening in the church God established. The truth will keep me firmly rooted in that church that Jesus Christ established. So I hope that this episode is helpful for you. If you have thoughts, feel free to share them with me at trenthornpodcast.com. Thank you all so much. And I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.